Good evening and welcome. It's KBC Arts, arts and entertainment in our region, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Tonight, we have music in conversation with Graham Nash. He'll be at the Fox in Riverside in early April, and you can catch him on KBCR-TV in the very near future. First, though, Emin Arazoglu Agalarov, though known more simply as Emin, a Russian singer-crooner who has a new PBS special out with David Foster.
The game is over now, and the guns are cooling down. This was the final act. We can't stop.
You can also catch Emin on KBCR-TV in the very near future, and he'll be in Los Angeles in late May. Lillian Vasquez got this conversation, and while I introduced him as Russian, he really grew up all over the place, including here in the U.S.
Love is like a dream. It's a crazy story. So my name is Emin Agalarov, and I was born in Baku, Azerbaijan, 1979, in December, so almost the 80s. And then my parents moved to Moscow when I was 4 years old. I spent another 8-9 years here. Then I was sent to Switzerland to boarding school. And then at the age of 14-15, I ended up in the United States, in New Jersey, in a public school, riding a moped, happily, with my driver's license at 15, where you get them in New Jersey. And then went to the university and basically just had an amazing time growing up.
How was your time in New Jersey going to high school there?
Well, I arrived and I was one of the two Russians in the school, and there were over 1,000 students. And luckily, I knew him from Moscow. And originally, he's just like me. He's born in Azerbaijan. And we were lifetime friends, worked together ever since on many, many projects. And going to school was an awesome experience because you get the complete and total American teenage lifestyle. Everybody's waiting for their license. Everybody's waiting for the first kiss to happen and for the first date and nights at the diner and commutes to the city just to stay in line to the club and not be let in because you're underage.
Did you start writing songs at an early age? Did you sing and play instruments before you started singing?
No, I didn't play any instruments at first, but always sang Elvis. And, I had Elvis posters everywhere in my house. I was so in love with Elvis, and still am, with his music and style, and collected stamps and cards, books and videos, VHS at that time. And my friends used to make fun of me, obviously, because I was like a dork who listens to Elvis while everybody else was listening to contemporary music.
Well, obviously that reflects, and one of the reasons we're speaking with you today is your new PBS special, Emin Live from Russia, with David Foster.
Ooh, look where Elvis got me.
Yes, and we'll talk about that in just a little bit. I read that you recorded your first full Russian album at the age of 17?
Yes, actually living in New Jersey because I was so homesick for the language and the music, and it was never released, obviously, because it was quite unprofessional at that time. And the first real album I released 9 years later at the age of 26.
Wow. You come from a wealthy business family. Was your father okay when you made the choice to be a performer rather than a businessman? But I'm guessing that it kind of prepared you for the music business because you had that business background.
Well, it's interesting because, now people look at me as somebody who comes from a wealthy background, but I grew up in the Soviet Union in very humble conditions like the rest of the country. And for the first 12, 13 years of my life, it was still Soviet Union. And wealth was not something that people had in Russia. And in the early 90s, when I was at the age of 13, when my father sent me away, he started making his first money, you would say, by, constructing, making computers to the country. So he was one of the first successful entrepreneurs here. But again, because he sent me away first to boarding school and then to a public school in New Jersey, I lived quite a humble life at that time because he was against pocket money. He thought that I'd spend it on alcohol and drugs, and he was probably right. So really, just to get myself anything, I had to go work for it. New Jersey gave me the opportunity to try myself out in gas stations and restaurants and coat hanging and Kmart, which I really enjoyed because it gave me freedom. And I started my own business on eBay, selling Russian items like watches, clocks, nesting dolls, Laker boxes, etc., etc., etc. So yes, I got a business degree eventually, and I was all geared up to lead a business life in the States and never wanted to work with my father. But then obviously I got convinced to come back to Russia and try the family business, and I got so involved, and I'm still involved. But music was always the passion that I just couldn't resist. So at some point I've decided that, if I don't try it and if I don't pursue it, it'll be like a dream I never followed. So I just decided to learn to play the piano and guitar at the age of maybe 23, and by 26, I released my first album of mostly my own songs, and it was quite a success here, and it was in English. Album released in Russia, strangely.
Now, you've actually recorded so many albums in Russia, probably a household name. Why now have you decided to explore the U.S. musically?
I always had the inspiration, never had the right door. And when PBS came around, quite friendly with Joe Bonamassa, we recorded a track together. He's a big PBS star.
Yes.
I know Andrea Bocelli personally. And when I met David Foster, I was like, you're like the superhero of PBS. I am a superhero in the music industry altogether, and he's an icon. So my management contacted PBS and said that we have an idea to do something special in Russia. Things got around to choosing St. Petersburg, the great square in front of the historical museum now, the Winter Palace. 50,000 people showed up. David Foster hit the piano. I did the singing. It was all American classics, a couple of duets. And now I'm going on tour in May, and I'll continue my relationship, hopefully, with David.
So I'm wondering, when the PBS special that you're referring to is Emin Live from Russia with David Foster. It's a beautiful show. I love the music.
Thank you.
And I was wondering how you came in contact with David Foster.
Business and music always connect, and we have a mutual friend. I happened to open almost 8-9 years ago a famous Nobu restaurant in Moscow. And one of the owners, Mayor Tapper, has been telling me for years, you got to meet David. You got to meet David. They're the best friends. And, you know, over 7 or 8 years, I never got a chance to meet David Foster because the timing, he's on tour, I'm in L.A., he's not, etc., etc., etc. When things came around for that meeting, it was so instant and obvious that it's going to be such an easy thing to put together, in the sense that we love music both. We love that style of music. He's an amazing musician. I can sing so-so, so it just happened.
Well, I think it's a little better than so-so, because David has a lot of friends, but he only surrounds himself with friends that he knows can either sing or quite dynamic in their performance. He's a smart man. I've interviewed him a few times, and while he's smart, he's also quite clever.
Very. I would say that somebody that has so many Grammys and even more nominations, over 50, I think, this is like a world record, just doesn't come around to somebody who is just talented. You got to be talented and smart.
I want to talk now a little bit about your choice. As you described a little earlier, you're pretty young to be a fan of Elvis and Sinatra. Do your Russian fans enjoy the American music and American standards when you perform them? They seem to really come alive during this PBS special.
Yes, I think they do, because first of all, not many Russian acts locally are able to perform this music, because it's not just being able to sing those songs. But I think it's that style that you have to absorb over the years. And because I really genuinely love Tony Bennett, Tom Jones, Frank Sinatra, Nat King Cole, and in my home, my parents used to listen to that music. So to me, to perform these songs is like singing something that is in my blood already. Although it's probably not, because I'm born in Azerbaijan and grew up in Russia, and this is foreign music to me in the sense of my geographical identity.
Right.
But at the same time, completely, I sing these songs as if they're completely my own material. I make them my own when I sing them somehow. I think this is why, because I do it so honestly, I think people understand it. And although I have my own repertoire, I write my own songs that become hits here locally and in some European places. But still, you come out and you do You're So Beautiful, or You're Always On My Mind, or You Don't See You Love Me. One of these amazing standards and ballads, the night just comes to life when you do these songs. Then, of course, you got to do a proper intro. You got to say that this is the song to which somebody has a surprise. And then somebody in the audience, for example, my fans ask me, I want to propose to my girlfriend. Do you think you can do it during the show? To my friend, I go, of course, and I'll sing a song, and I make them dance and kiss and do the ring. And, you know, the audience just cries.
No pressure there.
It's honest and it's real.
We're speaking with Emin, who has a new PBS special, Emin Live from Russia, with David Foster. Emin is E-M-I-N. For those of you that may not know his name, you will soon. Talking about the PBS special and some of the song selections, you do an Elvis medley and classics like Mack the Knife, You Are So Beautiful, and of course, Unchained Melody, which you dedicated to your mom.
Yes, Unchained Melody has been in my show for like 10 years now. It's probably one of the most beautiful songs ever written. Righteous Brothers do the best job performing that song. I fell in love with the song from the movie Ghost, like many others, but one of my favorite versions is Elvis's, where he does it on one of his last shows ever. He sits on the piano in 1977, 2 weeks before he passed away. I think it's just magical. The song is magical, and the story of the song is magical, and I think everybody who listens to it, they really get it.
I need your love. I need your love. Godspeed your love to me.
In this special, you have some very talented ladies who join you on stage, Annie Lorac and Paulina
Gagarina.
Yeah, both truly added to the PBS show with Annie performing You Don't Have to Say You Love Me and I Will Always Love You. Great deliveries.
She's a fan of Whitney Houston.
Yeah, clearly. And then Pauline doing Always on My Mind. Why were these beautiful ladies selected for this special?
They're two beautiful ladies. Annie Lorac is Ukrainian, actually, living in Russia. Paulina is Russian. These are the two top Russian female acts. And I thought that if we're doing a PBS special, it'd be exciting to have guest singers from this country to also come on stage. It would be strange if I would choose a man to be a third man on stage, David Foster, myself, and a dude. So I thought that women is the right choice. And to be honest with you, the prettiest, the best vocally, and these two just completely fall into that particular mark.
They were both stunning to listen to and also stunning to watch. Clearly added to your special.
Vocally and visually.
Yes, they absolutely were. How are American artists viewed or accepted with Russian audiences?
Oh, we constantly have American stars performing here. I mean, this is always a big show and big production, whether it's Justin Timberlake, who's also an Elvis fan, by the way. Jennifer Lopez had massive shows here 4 or 5 years ago. I was her opening act, which was an amazing experience. So acts do come here. They're very successful here. You know, we have American music playing on the radio constantly. Half of the stations play American music here, so.
Does Russia have music competitions like The Voice or American Idol? Obviously it wouldn't be American Idol, but do they have those in Russia?
Yeah.
And have you been a part of them in
yes,
any way?
Yes, we do. We have Russian Voice. We have all the analogies of those shows here. I've never taken part of any of these shows. Been quite busy with my own career, both here in Europe and now in the States, hopefully. And I just finished a massive tour. I did 50 cities around Russia in a little bit over 60 days. So it was
great. Wow, you were working.
Yeah, I always wanted to take my band on a really big tour. We've covered basically all of Russia. It was just fantastic. I'm taking some time off now.
And so you have your children instead there to relax with.
When we started this conversation, I had to run out of the room because it was so loud. I would not be able to do an interview. They're twin boys, 8, and they're born in New Jersey, actually.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
So let me ask, what does it take to write the lyrics for a song? What's your process? Is it the music first and then the lyrics, or the lyrics and then the music? How does it work for you?
It's going to make you smile. It's the whiskey first.
Oh, you're right. I'm smiling.
Sorry. It's a little bit true. You know, I sit at the piano and sometimes I have an idea what I want to write about. Usually that turns out to be a song that I never end up recording. But when you really are not thinking about what you're going to write, you're just feeling it. Sometimes the song comes to you and it takes 7, 12, maybe 10 minutes. You don't know how you've done it, but you've done it. And these are the special songs that actually carry some magic. I think they're sent from above somehow through your fingers on the piano and your voice. And usually they don't take much work. They just come very naturally. But that does not happen often, unfortunately.
Yeah, darn it. What languages do you perform in? I know English and I assume Russian. Do you have
Russian
a preference?
I started performing actually only 3 years ago. I recorded my first Russian songs. Up until then, everything was always in English. I actually have two different audiences and repertoires that I combine for my Russian shows, but in reality, you know, Russian music is slightly different from what I try to do in my English. And aside from the classics and the standards that I do in a classical way, I try to pursue the contemporary way of sound and the things that people could actually dance to, so my show does not consist just of ballads.
Nice.
It's an interesting combination because I have people of different ages, you know, teenagers come to my shows as well as elderly people.
And I'm not sure what elderly is. I'm hoping that's 65 and up when you say elderly.
That's 85 and up.
Okay, good answer. Are there American artists you would like to perform with sometime in the future that have been on your mind for a while?
Well, J-Lo is one of my favorites. I'd love to record something together with her. Over the years, we've established a relationship, so maybe this will come to life at some point. Enrique Iglesias, fantastic. Been to many of his shows, met him, and I think he's just great. I don't know, somebody like David Foster would be great to work again with.
That wouldn't be bad. Well, speaking of David Foster, I wonder if you'll share with our listeners what they can expect when they come to the Wiltern Theater in May in Los Angeles, when David Foster will be your special guest. What can they expect at that concert?
First of all, LA is David's base. So although it's my show, I think he's going to be hosting it because he is a much bigger star, obviously. We will bring the best of what we got. We're definitely going to bring a live band, definitely going to have an orchestra. And we're going to try and make it really, really, really special working with David. When he comes on stage, there's always room for some improvisation, which
yes.
makes the show really alive because he wants to change the ending, he wants to change the intro. You got to watch out. But that's what makes him amazing. He's not afraid to do it. And, you know, the audience, I think they go to see the live show to experience something that is happening just on the go and it will never be identical at the next show.
Will there be some of the songs that were performed in the PBS special?
Definitely. Some of the songs that we've done at the PBS special. I'll definitely do some of my own material. And maybe we'll premiere with some amazing new tracks that are currently in the works. Maybe something with David, so we have some time, a few months, so you will not regret it. It sounds surreal if you think about it from somebody who was born in Azerbaijan and grew up in Russia and was always an Elvis fan, and my fellow students used to laugh at the fact that I listened to that kind of music, to now be actually on PBS that I used to watch and admire and discover new talents while watching.
Well, PBS is known for that, giving young artists and new artists in the U.S. a stage to perform. That is kind of what they're all about. So we're grateful for PBS to bring new artists like yourself to the U.S.
And I'm so
showcase you.
As well, trust me.
I want to ask you one more thing regarding your time in New Jersey. I wondered what the comments might have been in your yearbook. Do you remember any of them?
Oh.
Well, like the weird kid that loved Elvis. Have a great summer.
Probably something about Elvis, because I always, you know, my sideburns used to not grow at that age when I was like 16, 17. And I used to still persistently try to grow these three hairs that never looked like sideburns. But I wanted to be like Elvis when I was a kid. Yeah, so comments like, this is the Russian Elvis here, I guess used to pursue me all the time, including the Facebook comments.
Well, Emin, it's been a delight speaking with you. We look forward to your show when you come to the Wiltern Theater in May in Los Angeles, where you'll perform alongside David Foster.
Thanks to PBS again for the opportunity.
And maybe someday you'll come home to me. And maybe someday.
Lillian Vasquez in conversation with Emin, performing at the Wiltern Theater in Los Angeles May 27th. KVCR.org/events for tickets and information. Also, Emin, live from Russia with David Foster, can be seen on KVCR-TV with air dates of March 3rd at 6:30 and March 10th at 7:30. Also on KVCR-TV and in Riverside soon, Graham Nash. We'll have music and conversation up in just a bit. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. Also at kvcrnews.org.
Welcome to Shout, Black Gospel Music Moments. I'm Robert Darden. Several groups with the name of the Gospel Heirs have recorded over the years, but my favorite is the Gospel Heirs of Dayton, Ohio. I'm not alone. Gospel historians Ray Funk and Opal Lewis Nations feel the same way. The trouble is, despite a career that stretched from 1954 to 1980 or so, not much is known about that group. Their record label, now that's another story. The Gospel Heirs were at one point signed to Don Robey's powerful Duke Peacock label in the roughest ward in Houston. A book could be, and probably will be, written on Robey, who liked the finer things in life and generally obtained them one way or another. Still, he had a great ear for music. Duke, his R&B label, boasted such stars as Big Mama Thornton and Little Richard, and nearly every major gospel artist was signed to Peacock, at least for a while. Almost all of the stories end with Robey not paying the groups their royalties and chasing them out of his office with a gun. As for the Gospel Heirs, their most coveted disc, featuring Charles McLean, who joined the group briefly in 1962 and became a sensation with his soaring falsetto voice before leaving the group for a shot at pop stardom, at Robey's urging, of course. But they were pretty good before McLean joined, too. From 1960, this is the Gospel Heirs of Dayton, Ohio, performing a wonderful doo-wop-styled rendition of Trouble No More.
Lord, I won't have to cry no more, no more. Do you believe me, children? I won't have to cry no more.
I'm Robert Darden. Shout! Black Gospel Music Moments is produced by KWBU, the Black Gospel Music Restoration Project at Baylor University Libraries, and is funded by generous support from the Pritchard Foundation.
You can hear Shout! Each Sunday morning during Weekend Edition and here on KVC Arts. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, online at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Up next, Graham Nash. He'll be at the Fox in Riverside in early April, and you can also catch him on KVCR-TV soon. We'll hear a bit about Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and the Hollies, of course. We're going to start, though, with what he's touring, his newest solo release, which came out just last year, This Path Tonight.
In all my waking days of wonder, all my ways of wrong and right, with all my dreams of clouds and thunder, I wander down this path.
This Path Tonight. So this was the first new album in 14 years. I'd really like to know what it was that made this happen, or finally happen, if I might say.
This Path Tonight. Where will it lead me? Crumbling rock and stones on fire.
You must understand something. In the 14 years that I have not done a solo record, I've made 16 CDs. I did Stephen Stills' 4-CD box set, David's box set, my box set, CSNY 1974 box set, greatest hits, demos.
I've
been incredibly busy in this 14 years. But something that happened in my personal life made me react greatly, and that was that I divorced my wife after almost 40 years, and I'm in love in New York City with a beautiful lady here, artist, and my life changed completely, and This Path Tonight reflects those changes.
It is truly through and through a reflection album of what once was and certainly looks to the future. I've kicked off the on-air version of this with the title and opening track, This Path Tonight, so let's address that one first. First of all, you chose to have this one open the album, and certainly a great one to do so. It starts with a gentle drive of the acoustic guitar, but then a much heavier drive with the percussion. Was this one written to be the first one, or did it feel it set the tone later on? You had a collection of tunes.
It always felt like the opening track to me.
Yeah?
You know, I've made so many records in my life that, you know, your brain goes to those places. What is the one that you open the album with where people can't take the album off? You know, Sweet Judy Blue Eyes, for instance. What, you're going to take the record off after that? I don't think so. You know, Carry On, for instance, on the Deja Vu record. Are you going to take the record off after Carry On?
Yeah.
I don't think so. And so we're always searching for those introductory songs. And This Path Tonight fit how I was feeling. It fit the beautiful portrait of me that my girlfriend Amy Grantham took on my first day in Woodstock, strangely enough. Even though I, of course, played the festival almost 50 years ago, this is the first time I'd ever been actually to Woodstock.
I guess the first time you were flown in on a helicopter and then kind of took off the same way.
Well, don't forget, that wasn't at Woodstock.
Oh, yeah, that's right. It was out on the farm, yeah.
Yeah, that was in Bethel.
Yeah, right, right.
But I've never been to Woodstock, but it's a cute little village.
Nice. Well, something else with This Path Tonight, it was, as I went through it over and over, it has several builds and crescendos going through it. Is this how it was originally envisioned, or is this something that maybe happened as it was being felt, as you were playing it?
Shane and I, who wrote that song, Shane Fontaines, who's the guitar player with me on my tour, we wrote all those songs, every single one of them. And it always seemed that This Path Tonight was going to be the opening track, and we just wanted to make it interesting all the way through to the fade.
Beautiful. One of the next tracks, Myself at Last.
Yeah.
By title alone, you'd think that this is being yourself, finally. Then you listen and the verses speak of going down a lonesome road, and this is what really caught me, to lose myself at last.
Right.
Spoiler alert, the song does end with you, or the protagonist anyway, having found myself at last. So please talk to me about this one. Is this, in essence, what we were just addressing at the beginning of our conversation about really finding yourself now?
Yeah, very much so.
When all is said and done, it's so hard to count the cost, and I'm rolling down this lonesome road to lose myself at last.
Since I wrote my autobiography a couple of years ago, it was an emotional feeling for me to at least get my life down. I'm now 75 years old. I know what I've done in my past. I know all the music that we've made. I know all that. I'm to move on to the future. And I must tell you, I don't know whether you know much about music or what happens, but we were supposed to go into the studio on the Monday.
Okay.
And so on a Sunday, the guys take all the equipment to the studio and unpack it and set it up. And then the band comes in on the Sunday evening and makes sure the drum's in the right position and the cymbal's at the right height and the bass player can see the drummer, you know, all those kinds. Then you have to sit down and play something, make sure everything's plugged in right.
Yeah.
So we weren't supposed to be going in until Monday, but this was Sunday evening. Mm. And the thing that we did to make sure everything was plugged in right was Myself at Last. It was the first attempt at the first song we ever tried.
To lose myself at last.
And is this the one that made it to the record? That's recorded.
That's it.
Oh my gosh.
And with everything I've ever done.
And a song like Back Home, for instance,
right.
You know, that Shane and I wrote about our friend Levon Helm, that was my demo from the bus.
Oh my gosh.
That I had to just bring into the studio and put a decent sounding vocal on.
So there was a slight recorded over, but for the most part, that was truly what... Wow.
That's the demo from the bus. And I didn't remember it. Here's what happened. CSN used to do that song, but it was kind of a little reggae and stuff. It was more upbeat thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we were in the middle of the record, Shane said to me, "Do you remember the demo we made of Back Home from the Bus?" I said, "Man, I haven't heard that in years. What?" You know, meaning months, not years. You know,
yeah.
I haven't seen that in a long time. Why? Play it for me. And when he played it for me, I said, "Holy Toledo, that's the track."
My gosh. That's either the last track. No, I think it's Back Home and then finally Encore. Either
yes.
of those could have closed the album nicely in a very full circle way. Was
yep.
Back Home the closer at one point and then Encore came along?
Yep, exactly.
Okay.
Encore is very simple. It's basically about me and anybody in my business that is in a similar position. Who are you when the lights go off and the crowd leaves? Who are you? Are you someone who wants to give to the universe or someone who wants to just sit there and take? Who are you?
Mm. That's truly incredible. That's more than I was expecting from that. As you're writing, Graham, certainly this has changed over the years, but what is the writing process for you? Are you the type to just hole yourself up in a tiny hamlet somewhere, or is it more digesting with Shane, for example, about what's going to be happening for the album, and then you just jam from there?
I think all of those things. For instance, you know, we cut 20 songs, and there's only 10 of them on the record, and 3 bonus tracks if you buy the deluxe version. But that means we have 7 left.
Right.
Now I'm going to go back into the studio and evaluate those 7, figure out if there's anything can start the process of making a record, and then go to it. I'm constantly writing in my mind, but the process is very simple. I have to feel something about what I'm writing about. If I'm not emotionally moved to write, I don't, of course. But if I am totally invested in something I'm writing about, I do my research, I try and find out every point of view, and then I write.
Are you the type to carry a small notebook with you everywhere you go?
Oh, yeah.
Now, when you finish writing one, is this the time to then go record it, jump on it while it's fresh as can be, as it were, or do you wait to have all of them written?
It really depends. Normally, I like to have at least a half a dozen before I go in there.
Okay.
You know, but, I mean, physicality, I mean, you know, I'm going on the road in 3 weeks, so I can't go in the studio and start a new record, and then who knows where I'm going in the summer in terms of doing shows. So it really depends, you know, and it probably feels right now as if I'll probably go into the studio at the beginning of the fall.
Okay. One of the other tracks on here, one called Beneath the Wave, and I'm just really naming the ones that really struck me. And one of the things that I did enjoy about this, by the way, is the flow of an album. This isn't the type of thing where you can pick and choose tracks, so I'm appreciative of that.
Good.
Looking at Beneath the Wave, are you telling a literal but maybe fictitious story, a seafaring adventure, or is this an allegorical look, again, at your life or the life of an entertainer, just trying to stay afloat?
Let me try and answer in a very simple form. Beneath the Waves was not the ocean. Beneath the Waves was people waving at us from the audience.
Did I just really miss the boat on that? Or
no, the boat, funny. Yeah, yeah. No, it's just in my mind, it's a story of me and the first band I was in the Hollies, you know.
Yeah.
And it's been 50 years before the mast of going out on the road and revealing yourself in your music. And it's 50 years because it's been 50 years since I started with the Hollies, roughly.
Yeah, truly incredible. One more thing on this path tonight. It seems to me a nice full circle kind of thing, like I mentioned earlier with Back Home and then with Encore. You start off the album with, again, the title cut, This Path Tonight, and then it's an exploration all the way through. Is it all you, these explorations?
Yep. It's all me. I only write about me. I'm always writing about me. I mean, who else is there in my life that I can write about like that? It's just me.
Of course you're going to be doing songs from This Path Tonight when you're touring.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm doing songs from the Hollies forward.
Oh, good, 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 good. I would hope, though, that people are just as excited to hear the new music as they are some of the classic
standards.
Well,
I got to tell you, that was very interesting. On the last tour I did, it was amazing. I understand if I do Our House and I do it well, people get on their feet and cheer and la, la, la. They've heard the song for 45 years. It's in their heart and soul. God bless it.
Mm-hmm.
But when you can get that reaction from a song they've only heard once,
yeah,
now you're talking.
That's incredible, truly.
And that's happened constantly.
Stairs in the moonlight,
In this extended yet still abbreviated time, I have a wonderful opportunity to ask Holly's related questions, and I suppose I will get there, but in order of importance in my little world, while I do still have time, I'm going to go first to your work with David Gilmour. So of maybe a dozen or less albums that I've ever bought without hearing them, two of them were David Gilmour's On an Island and then recently Rattle That Lock. So
right.
With these albums, you and David Crosby provided backing vocals on the title cut for the former, On an Island, then again, A Boat Lies Waiting. I'd just like to hear how this happened. First of all, did you have some sort of relationship with Gilmour anyway, or is this you get
well,
a call from his manager?
I, obviously, you know, the Pink Floyd's music has been all over the world for many years, of course.
Mm.
But Crosby and I were doing a show in London at the Royal Festival Hall, and Gilmour came to see us. And he came backstage after the show, and because it was a great show, and he said, "I've got two questions for you."
Mm.
I said, "Okay, what are they?" He said, "Well, they're not questions, they're actually statements."
Mm.
I said, "Oh, all right, what are they, David?" You know, he said, "Well, first of all, I want you to sing on this song I've got called On an Island, and it would be great if you and David would sing backups." So, of course, we did the usual thing. If it's a great song, fine. If it's not, who cares? You know, and he sent us the song, and we loved it, so we did that. But the other thing he said to us that night was, "And I'm stealing your drummer," which he did. So that's when our relationship with David started. And we did wonderful work on an Island. I thought it was a superb piece of music. And the one that we did on his other album, Rattle and Lock, is a beautiful song too.
Yeah, very, very beautiful stuff. And I have to say too that on the concert video for On an Island, we're lucky enough to get you and David Crosby shots of this. And it's clear that you are just as into it and just as happy to be on stage at that moment. I even caught you staring just slack-jawed at Gilmour as he's playing one of the latter solos.
I love David's playing. I think he's a very thoughtful, very emotional player.
And then later on you ended up being, I guess, going on tour with David Gilmour as well, and so you ended up doing back...
We've done about a dozen shows together so far.
Wow. Had you already been, you know, you can't avoid hearing Pink Floyd, but were you already a fan of some of the tunes like Shine On You Crazy Diamond, some of the things that you, I'd say, were privileged to sing backup on?
Yeah, Crazy Diamond particularly, right.
You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR, also at kvcrnews.org. It's Music in Conversation with Graham Nash, though we did just come out of that last segment with David Gilmour. More with Graham Nash just ahead. We'll have just a bit on his autobiography, photography, the Hollies, and of course, Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Let's continue now with Music in Conversation with Graham Nash at the Fox in Riverside in early April. Tickets and information at kvcr.org/events.
Through the cracks in the city, I can see the sad traces of yesterday's empires with tomorrow's bad dreams.
One of my colleagues here at KVCR, Ken Vincent, used to be in Seattle and on the board for Youth in Focus, and said that you are often a part of it, and I'd like to hear about your involvement, how it started, does it still continue, and in essence, what you've done with them. Can you speak of the organization, what it is, first of all?
Yes. Shane had these friends that came backstage one night at one show, and I asked them what they do, and they said, "Well, we make little videos of shows to show to children who are going to be in hospital for a while." You know, and I thought it was a great idea. So I said, "Next time we come, let's do the whole show for that school." And that's exactly what we did. We came back a year later to do a show. They set up video cameras. I got the names of a couple of the kids that were watching and directed songs to them and told them this is for Georgina, who's there in the hospital right now. You know, so it was a really beautiful thing to just entertain kids who are kind of locked in.
Wow, yes. So this was purely a videography kind of thing?
Yeah, but it was the live show, yes.
Okay, gotcha. Do you by chance have any, is there a program like this for music as well, where you're working with kids in the musical sense?
Yes, there's an organization started by President Obama and Michelle. It's called the Turnaround Arts. And what they do is they've got up this program that will bring musical education into schools that really desperately need it. obviously, you know that in any school budget, the first thing to go is the music and the art program.
Yeah, always.
You'll never see a football program abolished. And so this turnaround art, what happens is that rather well-known people adopt a school. The school I adopted is in New Orleans, and I went there and hung out in the music room and hung out with the kids and the music teacher and sang songs and just watched as their faces and their lives opened up because of the inclusion of music in their lives.
Beautiful. And you've seen so much, you've performed with so many people, but this one-on-one, this has got to be among still the most moving experiences that you would still have.
Absolutely.
To this day.
Wow. Absolutely, and that's what keeps me coming back for more.
Photography-related questions, but while we still have time, I want to address a few Hollies things. There were a couple of songs that were passed up by the Hollies, which became huge for CSN, at least Marrakesh Express, and was also Teach Your Children, was that one also passed up by the Hollies?
That was three-quarters finished, yes.
Okay. I don't mean to bring up anything contentious from the past, but I know that you guys have had pleasant regroupings. Do you ever hear from, say, Alan Clark or whomever from the Hollies, even good-naturedly,
yes,
saying, yeah?
I'm always in contact with my friends, yeah. And they're still my friends. It was a while. It took a while. It took, 10 or 15 years for them to realize that they were okay without me. I mean, they had two number one records after I left.
Truly, yeah.
How dare they?
A couple of their biggest songs, I have to say, were after
really.
Me.
So I think everything was good, I'm sure Alan wasn't happy with me, he'd been my friend since I was 6 years old, but I had to follow music that I'd heard, and when I heard me and David and Stephen make music, I wanted that desperately as a musician.
Certainly, and this is something that I had not been prepared to ask until I was about to call you. It's always spoken of you and David and Stephen getting together, and this, it's described in so many ways, this supergroup now together, the former Bird, and et cetera, et cetera. But what was it that you felt when you sat down with these two other guys?
Listen to us sing. Listen to You Don't Have to Cry.
Reality, I left years ago, it quite nearly killed me. In the long run, it will make you cry, make you crazy and fall before your time.
You Don't Have to Cry on the first Crosby, Stills and Nash record was the very first song we ever sang together in Joni's living room. How could you not want that?
Simple,
and that's what happened. I heard all this music and I wanted it. I'm a musician.
Yeah.
I get a chance to sing on Helplessly Hoping, on Guinevere, on Long Time Gone, on 49 Reasons, on Sweet Judy Blue Eyes. I'm in heaven. I'm a musician.
As simple as that. So you came to play and it clicked. There's the word
we can use. It clicked in a big way, obviously.
Yeah. As I stated, you can read about the fact that you guys got together, but I never really heard, and this is probably actually something that we could address in a different interview talking about your book. One thing that you can find in your book, by the way, we might have to dance delicately around it, but Just a Song Before I Go.
Yes.
This is in your book. I'd love to hear the origins of the story, but, and we don't have to go into what you were buying, per se, at the time.
Okay. It doesn't matter. Here's
okay,
what happened.
Okay.
I was in Maui, for a 3 or 4 day break, and I was due to, leave for Los Angeles in 2 or 3 hours, and I was at a house of a low-level drug dealer friend of mine in Maui. Just grass, and a few mushrooms and stuff.
Mm.
But he had absolutely no respect for me as a writer. He said, you're a big shot writer. I bet you can't write a song just before you go. Little did he know, he'd just given me the title. So that took about an hour.
That quick. I don't really care if this is cliche, but what is next for you? We mentioned the fact that you and Shane wrote, say, 20 songs and only a certain percentage of them made it to the album. So it certainly looks like you're getting ready for another album, or you could easily be well on your way. What's coming up beyond this current tour?
More creation, more beauty in my life. That's what I want. I'm 75 years old now, and I love beauty, and I will seek it out wherever I can. You know, I'm a normal person that happens to do something a little different than most people. Here I am living my life to the best I can.
Nice. I want to talk about photography for just a few moments. There may be some out there easily that don't know of you as a visual artist. You started with the Hollies so young as a player, as a performer. So when and how did photography end up coming up for you and being a part of your life, where you carried a camera as much as a guitar?
I've been making photographs longer than I've been making music. And I was making music when I was 13.
Mm.
In my book, Eye to Eye, the first portrait is of my mother that I took when I was 11.
Oh.
I started Nash Editions, which is a digital printing company, in 1990.
Yeah.
We changed the face of photography and how you print photography. We championed the inkjet process. And our very first printer at Nash Editions is now in the Smithsonian Museum.
I read that recently, and I understand with your interest in printing large versions of your work, I guess this is when maybe computer tweaking was new, you found yourself really at the cutting edge of large format printers. This came from this printer that you set up in a carriage house somewhere.
That's exactly right. And the warranty for the machine that cost $124,000 was broken in 10 minutes.
Oh my gosh, oh no.
I saw what the machine could do, and I wanted it to do what I wanted it to do.
Okay, I feel very thankful for the time that we've gotten, and one more just memory, if you can. In a way, Holly is related. You and Alan Clark and Tony Hicks formed Growlton Music, and you signed a young Reginald Dwight. And so, yeah, so do you have any striking memories of what this young Reginald Dwight was like before he became Elton John? He couldn't have been just some guy.
Yeah, absolutely. In 1966, I helped the Everly Brothers make a record called Two Yanks in England.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, this young, slightly overweight kid came in and played great piano. He was a piano player that made demos for Dick James, who was a music publisher that published the Beatles' music and the Hollies' music. And he was the piano player for the Everly Brothers. And sitting right next to him was a young guitar player called Jimmy Page.
So did Jimmy play there?
He was a session man.
Okay, okay.
He was a couple of years away from forming Led Zeppelin.
Wow. Well, Elton, was he still as flamboyant? I mean, just in aloud, the manner of dressing, the big glasses and all that? Or...
No, he wasn't really Elton John at that point.
Okay, just a regular
guy. But, I, you know, when I was making this path tonight, Elton was in the next studio, so we were talking and stuff. He's always treated me very well. And usually our conversations are not about music, but photography, because I don't know whether you know it, but Elton John has an amazing collection of photographs. And he told me that it was my collection of photographs that really inspired him to get into it.
That is incredible. No, I did not know that about Elton. I knew that about you. I wanted to ask you if you remembered what your first photo was that you considered art or that others looked at it as such. Is it that portrait of your mother we were speaking of?
Yeah, when I made that portrait, I knew that I was seeing differently than most, you know, 11-year-old kids would take of their mother, you know, probably in the kitchen with a rolling pin in her hand. You know, but I had captured my mother in a mood that I had no idea who this woman was, even though I knew, of course, that she'd given birth to me. But I caught her in a very interesting moment that made me realize that there was a certain impetus for pushing that trigger. You know, I could have done it, you know, 30 seconds before and it wouldn't have been as powerful, you know. But, you know, Henri Cartier-Bresson invented the phrase, the decisive moment, and that's very true.
Incredible. All right, one final thing, Graham. When we catch you in Riverside, is it a tendency to open up with a blast from the past, for lack of a better way of saying it? Some kind
of a... and I tell you why.
Okay.
On the last tour, I opened up with Bus Stop.
Mm, beautiful. Great.
And it seemed to put everybody in a really great place.
Yeah.
You know, I realize that there's a lot of fans that the Hollies have. I'm thinking of starting with On a Carousel.
Mm.
There's a lot between the Hollies and this path tonight.
Oh, certainly.
There's a lot of music in there that I'm going to be doing, too.
Certainly. We'll be getting plenty of the favorites, plenty of the classics.
You absolutely will.
Beautiful. Thank you, Graham.
Take care.
Graham Nash will be at the Fox in Riverside Friday, April 7th. Tickets and information at kvcr.org/events. Also, you can see the concert Graham Nash Live on KVCR-TV with air dates of March 3rd at 10 p.m. and March 18th at 9 p.m.
So take a breath and take another. And your soul will fly across the border, taking you back home.
And that's just about going to wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks once again to Graham Nash and to Aaron Cook for setting up the interview. Thanks also to Emmett on KVCR-TV soon. And again, tickets and information for upcoming nearby concerts for both Graham Nash and Emmett at kvcr.org/events. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, and Lindsay Boyd. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts, behind us now, for example, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet. So thanks to Sean as well. You can hear past KVC Arts programs via podcast at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.